Sind der Seid du ein, in the philosophy project.
So naturally there are three questions. What is the meaning of philosophical treatise? Why should we study philosophy? And this question can be answered in a deeper context. What if you don't study? Do we miss anything? In other words, is it indispensable to study the life divine? Now we have answered these questions in a general way, and it is in that context that we had proceeded chapter after chapter. Maybe we have a little time now to pause back and ask ourselves what we have discovered to be the nature of philosophy and why we regard this work as a philosophical treatise. We have also answered the question as to why a philosophical treatise should be studied and whether it is indispensable. So let us revise our answers which we had given at the preliminary stages. We had said that philosophy is a quest. And at the very beginning, the question arises, what is quest and why should there be a quest? The answer to these questions is varied. Why should there be a quest? What is quest and why should there be a quest? The most normal and easiest answer is, and in a sense even ultimate answer is, that quest results in possession of knowledge, or at least a capacity by means of which we can deal with our life better. At a deeper level, still a further question is it not possible without quest to have the capacity to deal with our life? We don't need to make a quest. It is argued sometimes that human being is so equipped that from his internal resources, without making a quest, he can deal with life better and better. And in this respect, it is said that human being has two inherent capacities. One is instinct, which is something involved in the human being. And if one guides oneself by instinct, there is no need to make a quest. Instinctively, you come to know not only come to know, but you instinctively do what is necessary. It's an argument. I'm not saying it's the final answer, but this is an argument. The second is that there is in human being, and this is more specially true of human being, because instinct is to be found even in the lower organisms. And you might say that these instincts are enough for lower organisms to deal with their lives in a certain sense, not entirely. Now in the human being, there is not only inherently the instinct, but there is something more. That something more is what is called faith. There is in the human being inherently what can be defined as faith. There is sometimes a confusion between instinct and faith. You might even say instinct also is an expression of faith. And it may not be denied. And yet, faith is little more in the sense that faith is a more articulated consciousness of purposiveness. Instinct may be present and it may act, and instinct always acts with purposiveness. But the individual who is an organism, whatever it may be, is impelled by instinct may not be conscious that it is purposive. In a human being, there is a larger base. So a self-conscious pressure of purposiveness is what may be called true nature of faith.
A self-conscious
purposiveness. Human beings have this self-conscious sense of purposiveness. It is inherent. Now, why is it called faith and not knowledge? We could have said that a human being has inherent knowledge of purposiveness. We cannot say that because conscious sense of purposiveness to be called knowledge should have in it the element of certainty of the validity of whatever is stated to be inherently present in the human being. Now, faith has certainty, faith has purposiveness, but faith does not have the sense of validity. This question of validity is very important in order to make a distinction between faith and knowledge. Faith is also a kind of knowledge, like instinct is also a kind of knowledge. But self-conscious knowledge involves the element of certainty of the validity. In other words, the word knowledge has this important element in it. When a statement is made to be a statement of knowledge, it must be a statement of self-consciousness, in which what is stated is known to be true, and more importantly, the certainty of which is grounded on the criterion of validity.
Can this be the same as knowledge by identity? Because you are identified with what you are saying, so inherently, this is the same.
With knowledge by identity, instinct also has knowledge by identity. Faith also has knowledge by identity. Intuition also has a knowledge by identity. And yet, there is a difference in all the three states. In the instinct, there is no self-consciousness. There is a drive which, when analyzed, is found to be laden with knowledge. There is an action which is based upon that knowledge. But the organism which is at work under instinct is not conscious that there is knowledge. Self-consciousness is not present. In faith, there is this self-conscious sense of purposiveness is present.
So can you give some example of it?
There is in the Bhagavad Gita a very important statement which is made that every human being has in him faith. Shraddha. The word uses Shraddha. It goes farther and says that every human being has inherent Shraddha which can be used as a definition of himself. It is that Shraddha, yatyat Shraddha sayavasa. That which is his own faith is himself. There is in Shraddha a certainty. It knows. But that knowledge is not yet so self-conscious. It is self-conscious. It's a degree of self-consciousness. But that degree is not enough to ensure that that can be regarded as valid. I may state this is true, but to say it is valid, something more is needed. Now, when we speak of intuition, very often we actually speak only of faith. A real intuition is one in which the statement which is made is not only known to be true, but is known to be truly true, validly true.
So, Uncle, in other words, you can say that when we make a statement based on our intuition, if it is intellectually validated, then it becomes complete. So if something is missing in us that we are not able to intellectually validate it, then it is only based on intuition, which is true, but I am not able to intellectually validate it, so that it is...
So it is still only faith. The real intuition is one in which what is known to be true and validly true. An intuition, that is the, normally we should not confuse because we use this word very loosely. Real intuition is one in which what is stated to be true is not only known to be true, but is known to be validly true. Now the question is, what is validly true? All validity of knowledge depends upon testing. Whatever is stated is to be tested. After having been tested and having passed the test, then you say it is true. Now, what is this process of testing? This has been one of the most important exercises in the history of human progress of knowledge. What is test? How do you know that what you know is true and it is by testing found to be true? So many processes have been devised for testing. What do we do actually in test? If you analyze the whole process of testing, all kinds of processes of testing, in the kitchen, how do you test whether what you have cooked is ready cooked? There are many ways of testing. Have you taken 10 minutes of fire? It's one of the ways by which you test whether it is well cooked or not. Even that is not enough. How much fire? What amount of fire? Is light fire or fire? Sometimes burning fire. Burning fire sometimes does not heat up as much as light fire. Different objects which are to be tested to be cooked or not. Even taking one grain and even testing with your fingers whether it is really soft, etc., etc. All these are tests. What do you aim at actually? Right from cooking to any other proposition, how do we know that energy is equal to mass multiplied by square of the speed of light? It's also a piece of knowledge. And we say it is scientific knowledge. What exactly is meant by having tested and the test having been proved to be true? The capacity to assert without doubt that what is said to be true is objectively true. This word objective is very important. Is objectively true. It is really so. not only that I sense it, but I am sure it is there. Unless you have a test which gives you this kind of certainty, it is not knowledge. It is belief at the most, or Shraddha, but not knowledge. Only that is knowledge in which the truth is known to be true, objectively to be true. Even when sometimes you say, I have a feeling, I am very unpleasant, disagreeable. Sometimes you get up in the morning, you feel not well. It's instinct, there is some kind of faith in you, you are not well. Now even with regard to your feeling, is it really, you are really feeling that you are not well? Or is it your, sometimes some people have the habit of telling people that I am not feeling well. There are children who do not want to go to school and they say, I am having headache today. He may say that I feel headache and nobody can find out. So you have a question mark whether it is true or not. He says I am feeling headache, but he may not have. How do you test? Merely even feeling that you are having a headache, you may not have the headache actually. Not only that you are not telling the truth, but you may really feel that you have got a headache and you may not have it. How do you know? Unless you are able to say that even what I subjectively feel is what I subjectively feel, even that has to be objectively true. Then you can say it is true. What we call intuition, that word should be reserved for that knowledge, where it is inherent, self-conscious, and where what is felt to be true is also known to be objectively true.
Then how would we differentiate between the scientific and the intuitive?
Scientific truths is a question of testing the truths by what are called methods of science. All questions are of testing. How do you test? Similarly, you can ask a question, how do you say it is philosophic truth or not? So there are philosophical tests. There are scientific tests, there are philosophical tests. There are what we may call moral tests. There are aesthetic tests. In fact, all the tests are connected with the process of reason.
But they also include the objectivity of them?
Yes. All the tests are ultimately aimed at proving that what is stated to be knowledge is objectively true. So unless there is this objectivity, you cannot say it is self-conscious, self-possessed knowledge. Now your question was, how is it different from intuitive knowledge? In the intuitive knowledge, there is no testing. All intellectual processes involve testing. Intuition is a power in which what is known to be true and objectively true.
Yes, without the testing.
That whatever is a taste test because of the fact that the object is known to be object because that object is itself the subject. This is called knowledge by identity. What is the meaning of knowledge by identity? Where the subject and object are so
actually it is only
identical.
It is only in intuition that real knowledge by identity is reached. In the rest, instinct and faith, it is only a trickle of the same.
That's what, that is why. We have to understand, however. You are right now. You have understood perfectly well. This is a very important understanding. We often use the word intuition. So this person has great intuitive power. What does it mean? More often than not, it is instinctive. More often than it's only faith. And some kind of trickles, as you said, trickles of this knowledge by identity. But real knowledge by identity, when we say the Rishi, it is Brahman is Satchidananda, a statement. You make a statement. Brahman is Satchidananda. The Rishi says Satchidananda. It is not merely that he has a kind of his own imagination. His subject and object, whatever object, the highest, widest, is known to be widest. When Sri Aurobindo says his experience of the Brahman in Baroda, stupendous silence. The mark of an object is the following. This table is an object. How do I know it is an object? Normally we have no question that this is an object. I am here and this object is different from me. But how do I know this is an object? What is the test of it? If I walk in the darkness, if there is a real object, I'll be knocked into it. So an object is that which stands out against me, into which I am knocked, which can't be annihilated. It stands out. Stupendous silence is a state in which you cannot eliminate at all, even if you want to. When do I say I got toothache? I cannot eliminate at all. I mean, I try my best. It's objectively true. It is there. I cannot throw it out. An object is an object when you are bound to knock into and you can't eliminate it. Now, Satchidananda, when it is stated, this is an experience it is stated. Why is it that there is a quarrel between empiricists and intuitionists? An empiricist maintains that what is objectively valid can be seen only through senses. That first of all, there is a sense perception that there is an object before me. Then there are tests again put. And all the tests ultimately are tested by sense experience. The tests are only to prove that from various angles of my sense perception, I come to the same perception. This table exists objectively because you are seeing it from this point of view, you are seeing from this point of view. That's why it is called, unless it is shareable, the shareability arises from this fact that my sense experience may be illusory, I may be dreaming. But I ask you, what do you see? Do you see it? Do you see it? And ever all of us see it. This is our testing. That is not more than that. Supposing if somebody says, all of you are deluded. There is no such thing at all. It can be said also. That's why even sense experience does not give you that guarantee of truth. That is why a philosopher like Hume, he led the whole conclusion to the extreme conclusion. He said, there is no such statement which you can validly make. It is true, he said, that I am sitting in my room. And I am not the room, it is certain. My room is different from me. And my entire room exists. Then, at a given hour, I come out of my room. My room is on a hilltop. Nobody else is seeing it. I go down. I also can't see anymore. When I come back, I do see it again. But when I was not there, how could I be sure it continued to exist? It is quite possible that this perception, whenever I reach the top, I do perceive a room. And as long as I am there, I always see it. But when I am not there, how do you know it exists?
So in that, Hume is trying to point out the inadequacy of the senses?
He says senses are inadequate to assert the truth or knowledge. That is why he said, you can only say it's quite probably it was existing. That also he said there is no guarantee. Even probably also he said you cannot say. How do you say probably? It can even be said that whenever you come, it is reconstructed every time. It was when you went out of the room, nobody was seeing it, so who could prove it was there? It's quite possible that you happen, whenever you come to your hill, you happen to see a room. When you go out, it ceases to exist. When you come back again, it comes into existence. It could be. That is why those more sophisticated scientists, they say, you have to test sense perception with some other props. Is there causal relationship? If something suddenly comes into existence, we find that nothing comes into existence suddenly. So you must see causal connections. When you are in a train, in a solitary place, the train is passing. Nobody in the train sees the wheels. Nobody in the train sees the wheels. Do wheels exist?
Yes, so that shows that the senses are not
really... Nobody is seeing. So you say that if wheels were not existing, the train may not be moving. We see train moving. So unless there are wheels, it may not, cannot be moving. I see moving, therefore wheels must be. But this argument is based upon causality. It is based upon causality. I believe that things in the world do not merely happen.
For anything to happen, there must be a causal connection. Therefore, Hume tried to show that this causality is a prejudice. How do you know that causality really exists in the world? So he threw out the idea of causality also. There are no such things as causes at all. This is called utter skepticism. You can say nothing to be true. And that's the end of all thinking, all process of knowledge.
There is empiricism and scientific knowledge, same.
Empirical knowledge is knowledge derived from senses. Word empirical comes from experience. Knowledge derived from experience is called empirical knowledge. Science is a body of knowledge. Empiricism is a method. You gain knowledge by experience. It's a method. Science is a body of knowledge where knowledge is collected by means of experience. Right? All empirical knowledge is not necessarily scientific knowledge. Empirical methods tested by various tests and you have come to the conclusion that is valid knowledge, and when that piece of knowledge is related to another item of knowledge and somehow put together, interconnected, it becomes a body of knowledge. So even intercorrection also has to be there to some extent. That's why science is a systematic body of knowledge. So you cannot merely say that all scientific knowledge is empirical knowledge or vice versa. There has to be further refinement. But it is true that physical sciences have so far claimed that all that knowledge is derived from sense experience. Therefore, empiricism and scientific knowledge seem to have gone hand in hand. Although, there are many people who have now analyzed and asked themselves, is it really true? Einstein is supposed to have said E equal to mc squared was not empirically found by him. He didn't experience it. He said, I had a flash. On the basis of it, he ultimately made experiments. Then it was found, it was true. Therefore, to say that all scientific knowledge is only derived from sense experience, even that claim is now not sufficiently supported. Although they say that ultimately, that flash to become a scientific knowledge had to be tested, ultimately found to be true in sense experience. Therefore, empirically, it is valid and therefore it's a scientific statement. Now, at present, our entire history of mankind has reached a point where scientific knowledge is considered to be the knowledge. Instinctive knowledge is not called knowledge. Knowledge derived from faith is not considered to be knowledge. Intuition is not supposed to be knowledge. only that knowledge which passes the what are called scientific tests. And what are scientific tests? Scientific tests are ultimately reducible to the affirmation of objectivity by a number of individuals. So that it is not one individual's claim I have seen. Or at least it should be such a knowledge which can be shared, even not shared with others, but which can be shared. This is the mark, the testing, this is called scientific knowledge. At one time it was said that scientific knowledge is scientific if it is inductively established. The test is induction. Now what is induction? That was a very important criterion of testing. What is induction? When an object is perceived and that perception is compared with another perception, another object, and that with another object, merely perceiving an object, merely as it is not enough. You should see another example of the same kind. Then you see another kind. Then you should be able to see in it some pattern. And when you see in them some kind of connection, which is not only a pattern of some kind, but a specific kind of pattern, namely the pattern of cause and effect. It's a very specific kind of pattern. When you can see a pattern in many instances, and you see the pattern of causality, then you make a statement that on the basis of the few observations we have made now, it can be said in all the cases it will be true. I only perceive a few instances, but scientific knowledge goes farther and says not only it is true of what you have seen, but if you can establish this pattern and if you can establish this causal connection, then you can even say that in all the cases of this kind, it is true. So induction is supposed to be a process of observation of a few, observation of pattern, what is called uniformity of some kind, and this uniformity further defined in terms of causal uniformity, then you can come to a conclusion. This is after testing in this way, you come to a conclusion that in all cases it is so. Now there is a leap from a few, so it is called inductive leap. Now this inductive leap is very important for science, because science does not claim that the knowledge it possesses is based upon observing the whole world, each and everything in the world. Science only says that we have whatever is our scientific knowledge, which we claim to be true and objectively to be true, is because we have seen a few examples In those few examples, we have seen this pattern, and we have established the pattern to be connected by causal connections. Therefore, we conclude definitively it is true for all. Therefore, you will see that in science there are propositions which are connected with the statement all. In all the cases, if an object is thrown from above, it will move downwards. In all the cases. Actually, you can only see one apple falling from tree to the ground, but you make an inductive leap. In all cases, it will be so. And then, whenever you do it, it happens. Even then, you can't say, I was in all. In any case, you can't see in future also it will happen. And yet you say, in all cases it is so. So scientific knowledge has got this character that it claims to be true of all similar cases if it is shown that those cases are governed by law of uniformity of nature and law of causation. So testing of scientific knowledge requires this kind of process. It's called inductive process. Now, in this time of Renaissance, in the 15th century when the Renaissance started, 1492 is supposed to be the dateline when the new age of reason started. You may see it's arbitrary date, but if you want to be more definite, Columbus discovered America in 1492. So, and in that year many things happened. So, in a rough manner you can say that 1492 is a dateline from where onwards you can say the Renaissance started. And the modern, all that we call modern, is the period of Renaissance. We are all living in the period of Renaissance. So modernity and Renaissance period are supposed to be coincidental. Now what happened in the period of Renaissance was a breakthrough against a claim that knowledge, the true knowledge, most important knowledge, is what is given in the Bible. This was the one important trend which covered a long period in the history of Europe. And that knowledge is what I call revealed knowledge. It is objectively valid because it is revealed. It is revealed by God Himself, one who knows everything. Omniscient God reveals to an individual who was an instrument or vehicle of giving that revelation. So Bible consists of those statements which were given through that special vehicle, special instrument, through which revelations have been made, according to which man on the earth is because there was man created by God in an act of creation, and within 7 days the creation was accomplished. And he had said it is good. That is, creation is good. That is a fundamental proposition of revelation. The world is good. Man was living a life of what they call life of paradise. And there were two, Adam and Eve. And there was a tree of life. And there was a fruit on that tree. And the serpent came and told Eve, the woman, who was created by God from the rib of man. And Eve was told by a serpent, this fruit is to be eaten. If you eat, you'll get knowledge. This is the tree of life, in which there is a fruit, which if you take, you will have knowledge. Eve was tempted, and she went to Adam and said, let us both eat. They both ate. And when God came to know, he had declared it was prohibited, and yet they took it. So they were banished on what is called the earth today. And man and woman were on the earth as a curse. We are all here because we committed sins. So we are born in sin. We are all of us, after the progeny of mankind, is a result of that development. This is the condition of man. He lives in sin. And he lives in this misery where it is. Therefore, out of great kindness of God, God sent his Son on the earth. He participated. He came on the earth. Came miraculously. There was immaculate birth. And he revealed to mankind that this is the condition. He told human beings that you are all living in sin. But there is a way of redemption. You can be all redeemed. And this redemption can be obtained if you admit consciously that you live in sin and you ask for forgiveness. And if you ask for forgiveness, and he declared, I am the Son of God who is one with God, and I am the gates. If you come to me and ask for forgiveness, I will forgive. And then you will be entitled
to return to God.
Very briefly, these are the statements which you'll find, and this cannot be questioned.
This cannot be questioned.
This is the knowledge. Knowledge is that which is known to be true, validly true. Why is it validly true? Because it has been revealed in a special manner.
But also when you call it objective, and for that you have said scientific knowledge means verification by X, Y and Z. I don't doubt Jesus or whatever, but the point is that one person had a revelation. How can you call it objective? Because nobody else knows what he alone saw. It's the same for Muhammad also. And therefore he went and gave a lecture. I believe all that. But the point is, when we call it objective, then there is...
Objective in the sense according to these revelations. These revelations are objectively true. Only point is, it's not scientific truth. Scientific truth is tested. The word testing is important. Knowledge, when it is tested by certain methods, then we call it scientific. See, there can be philosophic tests also.
Okay, so this is objectively true by the person who gave it. He knew. We had intuitive knowledge.
Right? Yes. He knew, and he was given the special, because God knows everything, and he himself came, Son of God came, and he therefore revealed, and he gave the truths. And this was foreshadowed by prophets who were also very similar, but ultimately he himself came to, so that no doubt remains about what is said. And it is now given to mankind. And this is the message for man. Man lives on the earth for what? To confess and to repent and to ask for forgiveness. And God is so gracious that if you really ask for forgiveness, it will be given. Ask and you'll be given. Now these are the statements which are believed in during that long period which is called by many people a dark period, dark ages. Now these dark ages are supposed to have come to an end when these revelations were questioned. And these questions came from two sources, from philosophy and from science. In the beginning, no distinction was made between philosophy and science. So they said there are philosophical doubts. Even Newton's book was on natural philosophy. What we call science today was a natural philosophy. So you might say that a new method of knowledge came to be established. It took time for history to develop this method, what I call scientific method. It took time to develop it. Men like Bacon and so on, they developed the theory of induction, and they said knowledge is knowledge only when this testing takes place. Now you must know that at that time these two propositions were very important. For a scientific knowledge to be scientifically true and found to be testably true, there must be a pattern. Why? Because it was believed that the universe has a pattern. Then only is there scientific knowledge. Scientific knowledge is knowledge about all. And unless there is some pattern, uniformity, scientific knowledge is not possible. And secondly, that there is in the world a causal connection. On the basis of these two propositions, which are called assumptions. And therefore you could have certainty of knowledge. Gravitation is a certainty of knowledge. In every case, in past, present and future, a fruit falling from a tree must fall on the ground. It will happen also after 5,000 years. This is what science can tell you. Now this climate of science continued right up to the time of Hume. 18th century. That is from 15th to 18th century, 300 years, this scientific knowledge was raised to this height that nothing should be believed. No statement can be known to be knowledge unless it is scientifically proved. When Hume came, he said, how are you sure that there is a law of causation at all in the world? It must be established on the basis of what you see, scientifically, by your own application, apply your own principles. How can you say that sun will rise tomorrow? Have you seen tomorrow? How can anybody say sun will rise tomorrow? So, it is not a part of your experience. Without experience, how can you say it? Then you can say, because it's a pattern. It happens always. It has happened till now. Therefore, tomorrow also it will happen. You say, how can you be sure? Then scientists had found out that Earth is rotating around the sun. Therefore, tomorrow there is bound to be the rise of the sun. So there is a causal connection. So he said, how do you know what is causality? In sense experience, you don't see any causation at all. You see only one thing happening after another. How can you say there is a necessity that effect must come out of the cause? It may not. So far it has happened. How can you see it will always happen? And there is no answer to this question. Scientists today maintain that these two questions are valid questions, and therefore now they have changed the characteristic statement about what is science. Even today it is maintained that scientific knowledge is certainly inductive. It is certainly something based upon observation of particulars and you arrive at universal conclusions. But you should always make a qualifications that this knowledge which is concerning universals should not be claimed to be universal. It should be claimed to be universal as far as one can make it. How do you know that will always happen? As far as we know, it is universal. It is likely in the future it will continue. So there's a knowledge, scientific knowledge is never certain. This argument which was there, scientific knowledge is certain, the certainty idea has gone. It is highly probable. There are degrees of probability of knowledge. And if whatever criterion you apply, there are now new criteria which have been stated. Karl Popper
is one of the latest philosophers who gave a great deal of thought on philosophy of science. And our dear Dr. Chattopadhyayji was a direct student of Karl Popper. So you can see how we are so near Karl Popper, who gave the latest formulation of scientific knowledge. So he said that whenever you make a statement in science, you should not claim that it is definite. Even if you are very, very definite, you should say it is definite as far as one can see. As long as a contradictory statement is not possible to make, it is true. Not only that, but you should always be in search of a test, which he calls test of falsifiability. All the tests normally are tests for finding out the truths, that they are true in all the cases. Now you must find a case in which it could be falsified. So try to make experiments to find out whether the statement which is made can be falsified. Even then, if you don't succeed, then you say it is very, very true or very, very probably true. But who says that tomorrow falsifiable statement will not be possible? So that is why it is called present knowledge of science is marked by high level of skepticism, almost like that of Hume, but modified to some extent, that you cannot say that this room will simply disappear as soon as all of us have left the room. It's very likely that it is continuing. Because more often than not, you always come back and seen it. And the probability has been very, very high. Even if you try to falsify it, it's not possible. Therefore, you can state that this is true so far. So, you are not so skeptical as Hume was, but you can state knowledge is possible to this extent, that whatever is known to be true is known to be true today. It is quite possible that tomorrow it may not be regarded as true knowledge. You have made some new discoveries. And there are, however, tests to determine the degrees of probability. When no falsifiability test has been made, you can say it is probable. When falsifiability tests have been made and they have proved to be unsuccessful, then you say probability has increased. So there can be high degrees of certainty. But to say it is absolutely certain, there is no such thing at all.
So the falsification is extended by extending the mind.
You take examples. If, for example, I say all crows are black, try to find one example when a crow is white. You go around the whole world, try falsify it. You have not so far falsified it, therefore, it seems to be universally true.
Well, like in scientific knowledge, when you say that the weight of X thing on Earth is this much. And now when they say the weight changes in space, so it's an expansion.
Yes, you are right. Therefore, the earlier statement was not true. Or not entirely true. It is true within certain conditions. And who knows those conditions also tomorrow, they may be changed. Who knows? So, scientifically speaking today, many scientists, I don't say all the scientists, because the philosophy which I now describe is not subscribed to by everybody. There are scientists who still believe in law of causality. And they say it is universally applicable. That law of causality is true. So they do say that if you establish causal connection, it is necessarily true. But large number of scientists today have come to the conclusion that you have no ground. In other words, they have said that induction itself has to be established empirically. In other words, the law of uniformity of nature and the law of causation have to be established empirically. At one time it was felt that one day we shall be able to prove it empirically. Bertrand Russell, another philosopher of science, he maintained that without induction, scientific knowledge is not possible. You have got to make a leap. Scientific knowledge is scientific when you can make statements about individuals leading to universal conclusions. So without some kind of universality, there is no scientific knowledge. And he said there is this leap from particular to universal is based upon law of uniformity of nature and law of causation. But these two are not empirically as yet established. But he said one day, empirically we may be able to establish. That was his hope. But now that hope is given up by most of the scientists that empirically you will not be able to establish law of causality or the law of uniformity of nature. So their conclusion is that knowledge as defined as true to be based upon testing is true only within certain limited qualifications. There is no such thing as knowledge. Nothing can be known. Basically, this post-skepticism is a ruling atmosphere. Nothing can be known. Except, so far what is known and not contradicted, we can say yes. It is workable, it is working.
So we know the other way around also. More from individual to we reach universality, and from universality also we can...
This is called process of deduction, but that is not, that is not empirical science.
Right.
Deductive sciences are those in which you arrive at general propositions and you deduce from them. Mathematics, for example, is called a deductive science. You deduct from it. Of course, even in science, you go on inducting, deducting, inducting, deducting, but basically, inductive process is the fundamental process of science. Now, I had to deal with these problems because we want to understand why we have to study life divine and what is the knowledge it contains and what kind of knowledge it contains and therefore, the value of that knowledge, because we said that the quest is always to increase our capacity. Are we capable of dealing with the world? This is our basic need of every human being on this earth, whether we can deal with the world better and with some kind of possibility of achieving it. I mean, all human beings are like that. Now, some people might say, even this motive, that you can increase your capacity, you can deal with the world better, you can arrive at fulfillment, all that is itself a kind of instinct or a faith at the most. It is not knowledge. Why should you be guided by this instinct or faith? Therefore, according to them, if you are having a quest, it is only because it happens. Quest happens. If you don't ask the question, why quest? We are so constituted that we are constantly looking. To say that I am looking, inquiring because I want to increase capacity, don't say that. I am only an insect crawling on the earth, happening to make observations. There's no purpose in it. I go on crawling on this earth. So this is one attitude, and one is also an attitude which is admitted, isn't it? A kind of possibility. The only problem with that is that people don't feel satisfied. There is something in man, that's why what we say is that instinct in man, and more than instinct, there is faith in man. All quests ultimately can be reduced to a fundamental quest which is based upon faith. Faith does not claim to be knowledge, but it claims and as a result of which I cannot resist pushing myself to prove that I know, to apply it and to say that it is realized. The word faith, really speaking, is to be defined in terms of knowledge. But that kind of knowledge. Faith is perception of a truth which is not yet tested, but regarding which I have untested certainty and I am driven to prove it and to realize it. This is the real meaning of faith. When Sri Krishna says Shraddha is the very man, if you want to define man, what is man? Man is not mere instinct. That's the important point. Man is basically, if Srimadha says, if man is not a mere insect crawling on the earth, and more than that, in what does it consist? Why Sri Krishna says, what is faith is man himself. He defines man in terms of faith. Faith is a kind of knowledge. It claims to be certain without testing. But it strives to prove it and realize it. Not only prove it, but realize it. That is the true definition of faith. It is different from the other meaning of faith, which is very often said. Faith is a belief which is supposed to be true and you act on it. Or you don't even need to act. It is true. Don't question it. This is how faith is very often defined. And therefore, when it is said there is a kind of a problem when you use the word faith, it is something opposed to knowledge. It is opposed to knowledge if by faith you mean a statement of a belief. Proved to be true and which is not to be questioned. In the case of a real faith, there is a statement which is held to be true, held to be certainly true, with certainty, but in regard to which there is a striving to test it, to prove it, and to realize it. This faith is not opposed to testing, is not opposed to what we can really call knowledge. Knowledge and faith are contrasted, can be contrasted against each other if by belief you mean only a statement in which it is to be true, but there is no attempt to test it, to prove it, and to realize it. It's a belief.
That is why Sri Aurobindo calls faith a dynamic faith.
That's right. That is, you are right. By very nature,
it's
faith
not
is...
Faith.
The very nature of faith is dynamic.
Dynamic.
And that's why when Sri Aurobindo says, faith and knowledge need not collide. An article of faith need not be rejected simply because there is an article of faith. We should give a great value to it. In fact, Sri Aurobindo says that until you test and until you get knowledge, what is it that will guide your action? You can't say, I'll sit until I can test. So Sri Aurobindo says, until you get, it is good to take faith as a crutch. So faith is not opposed to scientific, philosophic, ultimate knowledge.
And at another place he says that faith is progressive.
Yes, that's why faith gives you progression. Yes, it moves forward.
It's two words.
Quite right. So,
progressive.
Yes, so it moves forward and progressing towards what? Faith aims at arriving at proving that so that you can say it is, I have established it, proved it, realized it. When faith is turned into knowledge, and faith is turned into intuitive knowledge. Because according to this, intuition is the highest knowledge. Because all testing we saw, even science now has come to the conclusion that when you test in many ways, your knowledge is only, so far only probable, highly probable. Therefore now the only point is that if anything is to be claimed to be true, it can be true only if there is a capacity in man of arriving at knowledge of the object as object without error, without any kind of error. Now many scientists, many philosophers question whether such a power exists at all. They may grant that human beings have instincts. They may grant they have got faith. But to say that intuition of this kind exists, they don't accept. As Bertrand Russell said, It is true that many questions can be answered only if there are intuitions. But we refuse to believe that there can be any intuitions at all. Now, this is one statement. How do you prove that there are intuitions? We have only to take examples. That is to say, you take the scientific method of proving. What is scientific method of proving? You take examples, so far uncontradicted, such examples you take. Even if you make an effort to prove it to be false, you take even such examples. Then collect the data and then compare them. You still doubt them. That is what scientific method arrives at. Then, after doubting, you make a further inquiry. Verify them. Again doubt them, repeat them. And then you say, they have been repeated, and you go one further step, they are repeatable.
And this is like maybe if the rishi is the Vedic rishi. Yes,
yes.
All that has been collected in the Veda is also...
This is the method. This is the method. That is why Veda is a body of scientific knowledge of this kind. It is not called scientific because it is not concerned with physical experiences. Because today science has defined itself that we are concerned only with those experiences which are physically verifiable. But a real critic would say, why do you want to do it? What is the ground? So far you have done it, how do you say it is the only way? You apply your own argument against it. So far you have considered science to be that knowledge which is physically verifiable. But why should it be so? I am giving another method. There are many, many people who have claimed that they have intuitive knowledge. They have seen the reality objectively. They have knocked into reality and given, said, we have found. Now, there is such a vast body of such knowledge available to mankind, which many scientists dismiss as claims without proof. This is why Sri Aurobindo says, these are the people who profess to inquire but refuse to inquire. And we should not be guided by those who profess inquiry but refuse to inquire. There is a body of knowledge available. And the speciality of this body of knowledge is the following. There are clear statements of what is known. It's very important. While making the statements, they say basically these are only indications of the nature of the object of knowledge. Indications. Why? Because in themselves, that knowledge, that object, if you really want to describe, humanity has not yet found a language to describe it. In future, we may find a language in which you can give indication more accurately. Now many people might say a statement of this kind is itself does not qualify to be a statement of knowledge. A statement which maintains that it describes the object of knowledge. But this description only indicates it. Because in itself, it is indescribable. Such a claim, they say, we will not admit in our body of knowledge at all. The answer to this question is the following. That all scientists admit that there is something like a wedge. And if you are asked to define, to describe red, please tell me how you will describe red. This is a very elementary thing. Or any color, or any sound, any taste. All basic things, even in the physical world, are of that kind. I can indicate by the word red, but what it really is indescribable. Therefore, if red can be a part of scientific knowledge, why should my statement be not be a part of scientific knowledge? It's the first statement. The second is that this statement is repeatedly made by all those who have made a claim that they have knocked against such a reality. By a number of people. Now, in order to reduce any kind of brainwashing of anybody, because there can be, I can say the same thing as you are saying because you brainwashed me. It's quite possible. So, but if you come across such statements made in India, which had no connection with Maya civilization, and he had never known that any Indian rishi had spoken of it, and he makes a statement. In Norway, somebody has made a statement. In Ceylon, somebody has made a statement. So if statements are made by the people who had no intercommunication with each other, so you can say there was no brainwashing at all, then the veracity of such propositions gains in ground. Secondly, there are not only geographical distances, but even temporal differences. In time, something is forgotten. In a new age, again, the same thing is repeated by those who have never heard of it earlier. It may be that rishis have done it. I might have never read anything of the Vedas, Upanishads. And suddenly I make a statement saying I have seen. So again, if the distances of time and space are also established, then your statement is likely to be more true. Not only that, you go farther. That if these statements are made by those people who can describe the methods by which they arrived at this perception, which is also important, and say, these are the methods by which I arrived at this experience. If these methods are also verified, you also have followed the same method, I also have followed the same method, he has followed the same method, and you have arrived at the same perception, same experience, then it gains to further reliability. Then you can say that now a novice is taken and he is told, if you follow these methods, see whether by these methods you can arrive at the same thing which I have done. And that also is proved to be true. And there have been many instances of this kind. Therefore, this knowledge is further reliable. The same person is asked whether he has repeated experience of the same. It's not only once in a while sporadic experience. Many people have sporadic experiences, but you cannot establish a science on it. There are repeated experiences. Then you go further. There are rishis who have what is called abiding experiences. Experiences in which what is objectively known and seen is permanent. As permanent as I see the sky, every day permanently I see the sky all over. So similarly, therefore, if such a claim is made that there are rishis who have experienced this abidingly, and when you see abidingly, you see best, not only abidingly, this is further proposition. Why best? Because even that which is dim becomes more visible. In the light of that, I see more visible. What seems to be unconnected, I see more connected now. In a dark room I enter, and I don't know the design in which all the chairs are put. I knock against this table, this corner of the table. And I say, whenever I enter, I get knocked. Repeated experience. Then I continue to stand there all the time, day, 2 days, 3 days. Constantly I have got it. But gradually, by staying there, I begin to see that this table is so large. Not only one corner which I was knocking at. And that now I see that there are many chairs around. And then I can even see the connections between the chairs. There's a design in it. Then I can explain also that if I go from one chair to the other in the middle, I will find a gap. In darkness, I was not able to see, but now I have more light in it. I make a statement that I have seen that. Knowing which all can be known. It's a further statement. It is not only knowledge of a reality, that which is permanent, but having known, I know all. And this is also repeatedly, and then I can deal with all perfectly well. I can even make a dancing hall here if I know everything what is here. I can change the whole role in a different manner. This kind of knowledge is the knowledge that has been gathered over thousands of years. As Mother said in the agenda, that Veda itself is a result of thousands of experiences, of years of experiences. It has got that authenticity. It is not merely one or two speaking here. Even today we do not know this story because Mother said she has gone back, verified the thousands of experiences, years of experiences gathered as a, and where there is a culmination of that. Not only that, afterwards that knowledge was lost. Then came other batch of rishis. and they verify by the same methods which are found to be in the Veda. That is Vedanta. This is the authenticity of Vedantic experience. Therefore, the statement of their Vedantic knowledge is to be stated clearly somewhere. So you might say, first of all, the life divine is a statement of the Vedanta which says that ultimate reality has been seen. That this reality is Satchidananda, that is further known, it is Satchidananda. And that in the light of this, all experiences of the world can be explained. Yasmin vijyate sarvam vijyatam bhavati. That which is when known, everything becomes known. What is that knowledge? It is that statement which Sri Aurobindo makes in this Life Divine.
It's a very important statement in chapter number 7. I don't know, this is from the bottom, 5th paragraph. The ego and the chapter number 7, 5th paragraph from bottom. This is one of the most important statements in the Life Divine. Have you got it? The ancient Vedanta. Sri Aurobindo, the distinction between ancient Vedanta and later Vedanta. Later Vedanta is a Vedanta of Brahma Sutra, Bhadrayana, and the developments of Brahma Sutra through Shankara, Ramanuja and others. So Sri Aurobindo does not refer to that later Vedanta. So he says the ancient Vedanta presents us with such a solution. The whole world designed everything, the solution. All that you want to know, the riddle of the world, the ancient Vedanta presents us with such a solution in the conception and experience. Conception means that description is given, therefore it is conceived. In the conception and experience of Brahman as the one universal and essential fact. Fact, which cannot be, it's knocked, which you knock into, whether you like it or not. It's a fact. As one universal, and it's, every word is important, as universal and essential fact. And of the nature of Brahman as Satchidananda. This is the nature that when you taste it, it is Satchidananda. Ananda, you can eat it as it were, and you feel ananda in it. Such is the nature of it. Now, it is in this view that the whole world can be experienced. And what is the whole world? In the next paragraph, Shri Aurobindo describes the whole world and explains it in one word. It's a marvelous statement. In this view, the essence of life is the movement of a universal and immortal existence, that is Sat. All life, that is, all that you want to know is the life. What is this life? So, all life is the movement of a universal and immortal existence. The essence of all sensation and emotion, this is another aspect of our experience. The essence of all sensation and emotion is the play of a universal and self-existent delight in being. What is the third element of experience of the world? The essence of all thought and perception is a radiation of a universal and all-pervading truth. The essence of all activity is the progression of a universal and self-effecting good. In terms of Satchidananda, all that we can call in the world, and all that we can call in the world is nothing but all life, all sensation, all emotion, all thought, all perception, and all activity. There is nothing in the whole world excepting this, all our experience. You might say the whole of the life divine is these two paragraphs, you might say. All the problems of existence have been stated here. That is, problems of existence. All that is here, life is described here, sensations are described, experiences are described, all thoughts are described, all activities are described. This is all, the totality, and all that is shown to be nothing but expression of Satchidananda, which is seen and experienced, verified, undeniably, again and again. You can walk into Satchidananda all the time. Based on this knowledge, this is the knowledge which is presented in the Bhagavad Gita. And further, in the light of this, solution is given. All that is still found to be yet enigmatic, where you find a riddle, what is still not realized, and you do not know how to realize it, a test solution is also given. So you must say the whole of the life divine, this is the importance of the study of the life divine. If you want to see the totality of all that is to be experienced, to be seen, and if you want to see the totality of the fundamental problems of which you are bound to find, try to find solution, without which you cannot remain, this is expounded in this great work, right away. But there is a further point in it. It is stated in terms of philosophy. It's a philosophical work. So now we come to that question, why? Why Sri Aurobindo has stated this knowledge in terms of philosophy?
So the statement that you last read, the statement that you last read is an enunciation not only of Satchidananda but also Satyam, Shivam and Sundaram.
That is explicable in the terms of Satchidananda. Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram are expressions. Satyam, Sundaram, Sundaram, they are expressions. But the real reality is Satchidananda.
Which is an immortal, is the movement of the universe in an immortal existence. That is Sat.
Sat.
Then he says, if the way of the universal and self-existent delight in being, which is Ananda, then there is a radiation of a universal and all-pervading truth.
That is
Sat. Not chit.
No, no, that the is, last it is chit. So perception and thought are all chit.
Again chit. And the progression of the universal and self-effecting good is
Ananda again, but it's all put together. It's good your time, no? Otherwise, such things cannot be explained unless you have got such leisure and time to talk about. Philosophy should be leisurely, when there is no pressure of time, There is no bell ringing.
Why this knowledge is expounded philosophically?
And what is philosophy?
Why Sri Aurobindo has not described it scientifically? Why has he not described it poetically? Why has he not expounded in the language of the Upanishads? He could have written another Upanishad in the same style as the ancients. The answer is that Sri Aurobindo has expounded this also scientifically in the book called Synthesis of Yoga. It's a scientific statement which gives methods, develops the methods, describes all the experiences at different stages, how they are verified, what happens when you verify. The complete statement is available in the Synthesis of Yoga. Even poetically it explains the whole thing in Savitri. So it's another method of exposition. In the Upanishadic form also has written aphorisms and thoughts and so on. That also is available. A future musician may put life divine into music, perhaps. A mother wanted 1,000 players in an orchestra at one place and expounding a huge piece of music, cosmic music as it were. And if you read the life divine, actually you do feel an experience. If you really put your ears, musical ears, to the whole book, you find a huge orchestra. As I said earlier, the very first chapter is like a cosmic sound in which all that is to be said is said. One cosmic sound. The first chapter is the one cosmic sound. Everything is contained in it, out of which all kinds of tunes can be then traced and can be developed. The first four chapters may be regarded as the principal notes of this music. And these three chapters may be regarded as accompaniments of those tunes, notes. And these seven chapters, if you put them together, it is the one cosmic sound manifested primarily in seven sounds, as it were, of which the first three are principal sounds, and other three, the accompanying sounds. So if some musician were to compose a cosmic musical piece, then these seven chapters could be summarized in that one first movement. And these last three chapters on which we are now concentrated for the last three or four sessions are extremely important, without which the first starting point is not complete. But this is a musical presentation, you might say. But why Sri Aurobindo has chosen the philosophical method of exposition of these truths? Sri Aurobindo says philosophy
is not indispensable in man's quest. Therefore, Life Divine is not written as something indispensable for everyone. So it's the first thing to be answered. Life Divine is not written as something indispensable. The synthesis of yoga is, it's an indispensable statement because of the scientific knowledge. And if you really want to attain the highest, synthesis of yoga is indispensable. But even that, Sri Aurobindo says, is not absolutely indispensable. In that very book he says that this Shastra of synthesis of yoga is actually in the heart of every man. And if one cultivates this inmost heart all the time, he does not need to read the synthesis of yoga. Provided that condition is fulfilled. The real Shastra of yoga, as Sri Aurobindo says, is the eternal Veda which is in the heart of every thinking and living being. And it is in that way, yogic knowledge, which is the highest mode of knowledge, can be attained by subjective development of oneself, coming to that point where the objective knowledge is seen to be objective, where subject and object become identical, and that no book can give you. So even when synthesis of yoga you read, it may be regarded as very important, almost indispensable, but not entirely indispensable. So you might even say that even if these books don't exist, this knowledge will be cultivated. People will come. They will proceed. But storage of knowledge, whether you like it or not, is in the human progression helpful. If you don't store that knowledge, something else will be stored. So better to store something that is worthy of store. It is from that point of view that, as Sri Aurobindo said, for that sake he has written all this, so that it may be of some help. And that too has written differently because for different individuals and different approaches, there can be scientific approach, there can be philosophic approach, poetical approach. And he has expounded all that. He has made available. Now, philosophical approach, although not indispensable if you really want only knowledge and nothing else, but in a sense, philosophical knowledge is indispensable because of the fact that for a large number of human beings, the direct method of knowledge of yoga is almost impossible. For a large number of people. And therefore, whenever you want to communicate to a larger humanity philosophical approach is of capital importance. Not only of importance, but of capital importance. So there is a chapter in the Life Divine called The Evolution of the Spiritual Man. Chapter number 24 in Module 2. Where Sri Aurobindo speaks of, this is in my book 780, but in that chapter, what I want to speak of is a paragraph which begins with an intellectual approach. 877. There Sri Aurobindo speaks of why philosophy at all, why philosophical approach. Sri Aurobindo, I'll read out to you. An intellectual approach to the highest knowledge. Vedanta is the highest knowledge. So an intellectual approach to the highest knowledge, the mind's possession of it is an indispensable aid to this movement of nature in the human being. Now he explains why it is indispensable. Ordinarily, on our surface, man's chief instrument of thought and action is the reason, the observing, understanding, and arranging intellects. In any total advance of evolution or evolution of the spirit, not only the intuition, insights, inner sense, heart's devotion, a deep and direct life experience of the things of the spirit have to be developed, but the intellect also must be enlightened. And satisfied. Our thinking and reflecting mind must be helped to understand, to form a reasoned and systematized idea of the goal, the method, the principles of this highest development and activity of our nature, and the truth of all that lies behind it. Spiritual realization and experience, an intuitive and direct knowledge, a growth of inner consciousness, a growth of the soul, and of an intimate soul perception, soul vision, and a soul sense are indeed the proper means of the evolution. But the support of the reflective and critical reason is also of great importance. Not only of reason, but critical reason. If many can dispense with it because they have vivid and direct contact, like Ramakrishna, because they have vivid and direct contact with inner realities and are satisfied with experience and insight, yet in the whole movement it is indispensable. If the Supreme Truth is a spiritual reality, then the intellect of man needs to know what is the nature of that original truth and the principle of its relations to the rest of existence, to ourselves and the universe. The intellect is not capable by itself of bringing us into touch with the concrete spiritual reality, but it can help by a mental formulation of the truth of the spirit, which explains it to the mind and can be applied even in the more direct seeking. This help is of capital importance. It is because of this importance that the life divine is to be studied, both for ourselves and for the others. In any case, it is extremely important for those who want to communicate the highest knowledge to the others. In the time of the Upanishads, the knowledge was to be given to select few who are tested. For them, Upanishads was enough. But this is not the aim. The aim here is to give to the whole mankind. According to Sri Aurobindo, today we have reached a stage where this knowledge has become indispensable. It is pressing upon mankind today. Even those who are skeptical of spirituality are obliged to tell mankind, give to your children spiritual education. They are obliged to say this because they find it is indispensable for the very survival of man. It is so important. They have reached a stage where the whole mankind has to be given spiritual education as a policy. Why? This is a necessity of present day. Now, in that necessity, in that context of necessity, this knowledge has to be expounded. And this knowledge has got therefore to be intellectual. Why? Because mankind, for the mankind, in a large way, is not capable of jumping straight into direct experience. The intellect has to be taught. Because intellect normally seeks. It's a seeking instrument. Intellect cannot be stopped in are seeking, that is the nature. Intellect seeks always. It's very important that intellect has one very important force in it. There is, as it were, a faith in intellect. Because faith is something which it doesn't know, but it has an impulsive force. It forces, as it were, intellect because it's a faith. What is a faith? That there is a truth which pre-exists. The truth which pre-exists, there is a truth. It may be argued that truth doesn't exist at all. What is the truth? It's truth itself. But intellect cannot question. All intellect is nothing but elimination of error and arrival at truth. Why does it do it? Because it has a faith that there is a pre-existent truth. Ultimately, you may say that I made all effort, it did not find, didn't find truth. But intellect, as long as it remains intellect, it is as it were incurably present. Of course, this faith is not so strong as in our sensation when you are pain. Why do we try to eliminate pain? Intellect also tries to eliminate error all the time. Why? Because it has a faith, there is a truth. Now similarly, pain also in sensation, why does a sensation always tries to eliminate pain? Why? Irresistibly. You can't say you may do it, you may not do it. Pain is having such a tremendous pressure in it, it must seek ananda. In sensation, ananda is, as it were, inlaid. In intellect, truth is inlaid, but not so powerfully, because one can leisurely wait. It doesn't have that much of force in it. But ultimately, whenever it tries, what is the fundamental function of intellect? To examine. It's a beautiful sentence, chapter number 7. In my book is page number 54. Yet it is in the principle of reason itself. You got it?
Yeah.
56.
Yet, you got it? 56. Yet in the principle of reason itself, there is the assertion of a transcendence. For reason, this is the best definition that Sri Aurobindo gives of rationality. I'll be calling many times sitting for the sentence. Sri Aurobindo gives here the definition of reason itself.
Reason is in its whole aim and essence the pursuit of knowledge. The pursuit, that is to say, of truth by the elimination of error. Its view, its aim, is not that of a passage from greater to a lesser error. It supposes a positive, pre-existent truth towards which, through the dualities of right knowledge and wrong knowledge, we can progressively move. If our reason has not the same instinctive certitude with regard to the other aspirations of humanity, it is because it lacks the same essential illumination inherent in its own positive activity. We can just conceive of a positive or absolute realization of happiness, because the heart to which that instinct for happiness belongs has its own form of certitude, is capable of faith, and because our minds can envisage the elimination of unsatisfied want, which is the apparent cause of suffering. But how shall we conceive of the elimination of pain from nervous sensation or of death from the life of the body? Yet the rejection of pain is a sovereign instinct of the sensations. The rejection of death, a dominant claim inherent in essence of our vitality. These things present themselves to our reason as instinctive aspirations, not as realizable potentialities. Right, no? This is the fundamental reason why intellectually, whether one likes it or not, one can postpone
There has been a case of pain, you can't postpone, saying, I can wait till tomorrow. That also we do sometimes, saying, I have pain, but I am tolerable. But a time comes when you say, not a single second I want, when I can bear it anymore. Unbearable. Similarly, in the intellect also, a day comes. There are human beings who feel such a tremendous necessity. Intellectually, one must see what, and that again we come back to that paragraph which we are reading. What is the need of that intellectual? It is this. If the supreme truth, as I said, truth is a search which is undeniable to the intellect, then that search is the search of a supreme truth. All error to be eliminated. If the supreme truth is a spiritual reality, then the intellect of man needs to know what is the nature of that original truth. And, so this is a fundamental thing in philosophy, what is the nature of that original truth? Original truth. And the principle of its relations to the rest of existence, to ourselves and the universe. This is all philosophy. This promises only this much. This is all that philosophy does. If the supreme truth is a spiritual reality, it's a question mark. He doesn't say it is. The intellect of man needs to know what is the nature of that original truth and the principle of his relations to the rest of existence, to ourselves and the universe. In fact, basically all philosophical questions are this. When somebody says, do philosophy, what is the meaning of doing philosophy? Well, it's an educational philosophy. I say, because she has to do educational philosophy. What is educational philosophy? Educational philosophy is determine what is fundamentally the truth of education. What is it that we can call education as education? As distinguished from what is not education. That activity which we can really properly call education. What is the meaning of it? Why do we call it education? What is it that we'll call that activity? Surely all activities are not educational activities. I'm eating my food every day. It's not an educational activity. What is that activity which is truly educational activity? And why do I call it educational and not all other activities educational? That distinctive feature. What are the elements of that activity? And defining all the elements of that and how all the elements of that activity are interrelated, the principle of relations between them and its relations with all other fields, so that you have a distinguishing mark. So when similarly political philosophy, what is political philosophy? It is consideration of what is political activity. Exact definition. Which is not educational activity, which is not health activity, which is not social activity, which is not cultural activity, which is not economic activity. What is it that I call political activity? What is the essence of it, distinguishing mark? Why it should be, that is also further question, why political activity is to be what it is, and what is the purpose of it? What are the connections of political activity with among all other activities of political activities? Distinguish between principal political activity, subordinate political activity, peripheral political activity, and to relate them with one with the other.
Once you give the definition of political philosophy,
yes, you can.
That is the study of the ultimate.
Yeah, ultimate of that activity. Yeah, quite right.
In education also, so, differentiates.
Correct, absolutely, ultimate.
The ultimate study of that ultimate reality, wherever it is called.
Right. So this is what has to be done. If you want to give to mankind the highest spiritual truth, it is of capital importance that it is given to mankind through philosophical statement. Even if you'd like to poo-poo it or to mental, it is still something that is indispensable. Even people who say, oh, we are not bothered about intellectuality, we can tell them, my dear friends, it is at your peril. You may not be bothered about it, but a time will come when you are obliged to do it. All human beings at one time or the other are required to approach it, unless you are like Sri Ramakrishna, where you can directly jump into direct experience.
But he could have gone through the intellectual activity in his previous birth.
What might be, who knows?
He reached a point where he was
quite possible, but
prepared for.
But at least in this life he didn't need it. So we can say there are people who can dispense with it. But this philosophical activity is very important. Why? Because human beings are principally having one faculty which they call intellect. It's a faculty of man. In that faculty there is this inherent urge, faith you might say, which wants to know pre-existent truths, find it out, determine it fully, clearly. In the intellectual terms, that is to say, in terms of words, what are intellectual terms? I mean, what we say, intellectual terms means what? In words, whatever truth is to be described, is to be described in precise words. Such words which will convey to the intellectual person the information about what is that reality, if not the experience of it, but information about it, which will incite upon into the individual some imagination of it. Insight into the individual aspiration to experience it, not only to have information, but to experience it. So, to describe it, then to say how that ultimate truth, why it is ultimate, it has to be convinced it is ultimate, and there is nothing farther than that. How do you arrive at that conclusion? That also is a part of philosophy. This is the ultimate and the highest and nothing more. And having done that, is it capable of explaining all the rest of the world? If so, how does it explain all the rest? This activity is to be supplemented by further problems. If you still have a problem which you are facing, then can you find the solution of that problem in whatever is stated to be ultimately real? And how you can find a solution to that problem? This is a necessity which human beings do feel at one time or the other. And when you want to do it for a larger mankind, then this is indispensable, not only capital. In that context, it is indispensable. Even for those who want to dispense with it, even they sometimes will require this. And there it is of capital importance. But when you want to convey it to mankind in a large manner, because most of the human beings are incapable of entering into it, and yet it's important for them. So you've got to have philosophy. And that is why if our interest is only to do yoga, we don't need to read Life Divine. Even then, to some extent, yes. But if you want to convey it, even for our own joy, if you want to express, even our intellect also is to be satisfied. Our own intellect has to be satisfied. Some people might say, I don't bother about satisfying my intellect. It's all right. Many people can dispense with it. They don't want to labor so much. But there are cases where intellectual has to be completely satisfied. And only when it is satisfied, that's all right, then I will now do it. So, for them it is indispensable. And that is why, as I was saying in the beginning, that I was in need of revising what you have done so far. And now when you come next time, we shall proceed with the 5, 6, 7 in a greater depth. Although I have taken a few paragraphs here and there, but that is by way of introduction. All right, so next time. Are you bored now? Huh? Yes?